Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our third hour. It is very nice to have you with us. When the Supreme Court handed down its decision in Dobbs versus Jackson, the landmark case overturning Roe v. Wade, it marked a turning point in the lives of millions of Americans. It also was the culmination of a decades-long movement whose grievances were embodied by the man who wrote the court's opinion, Samuel Anthony Alito Jr. Prize-winning journalist Peter Canellos will tell us about his new book, Revenge for the 60s, Sam Alito and the Triumph of the Conservative Legal Movement. It is the first ever biography of the most pivotal justice on the Supreme Court, whose decisions, like the overturning of Roe, are certainly reshaping and driving the reshaping of America. Peter is the author of The Great Dissenter, the story of John Marshall Harlan, America's judicial hero, and the editor of the best-selling Lost Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. He's been Politico's executive editor, leading the newsroom during the 2016 presidential coverage, and the editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Again, the new book is Revenge for the 60s. Peter, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thank you so much, Joe. It's great to be here.
Really nice to have you. Am I saying your last name correctly?
You are, indeed.
All right. Peter Canellos is the author of Revenge for the 60s, Sam Alito and the Triumph of the Conservative Legal Movement. At what point did you start looking at this and to write a book about this man and ultimately the impact that he has on this country, but certainly on the Supreme Court?
Well, my interest started with the conservative legal movement itself. It has been the story of my lifetime in the law. It has been the story of almost everybody's lifetime in the law. How in 40 years, one movement that started basically with, you know, one conference at Yale University 40 years ago, how that movement has grown to have a 6-3 majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, to have its adherents occupying about half of our federal judgeships, and to dominate all of the thought and discussion of the law in so many ways, in all of these ways that touch on people. We're talking about abortion. We're talking about affirmative action. We're talking about voting rights, as we saw just yesterday. And the question has always been for me, where did this come from? And how did we get here? And the answer is not exclusively, you know, talking about originalism versus a living constitution and getting into the nuts and bolts of some of these cases. It's a social and cultural story that is resonant in American history. The people who started this movement had a specific impetus, and it came out of the 1960s, out of what we consider the protest movements of the 1960s and the early 1970s. Those movements offended their sense of what America is, and their sense of what America is was heightened in an odd way, I think, because many of them were, like Samuel Alito, the son of immigrants or the grandchildren of immigrants. They had their own European grandparents telling them that, you know, America was the great hope for all of mankind and the place where you can transform your life and the place where people freeing oppression came to. During the Cold War, those views were very reinforced by public schools, contrasting American freedom with totalitarianism around the world. And so I was looking for somebody whose personal life story embodied those values. And Sam Alito's absolutely does. And he is, as you said in your very eloquent intro, you know, he's the pivotal justice on the court right now, intellectually. And he best embodies this movement that has taken over the law as we know it.
Can you talk a little bit, just before we get into the nitty-gritty here, of his ascent to the court and what we even learned from that?
Well, his ascent from the court was fraught with politics. He had been elevated by the early conservative legal movement, which was identifying young, talented conservatives, this was the, by the movement, we mean, you know, Ed Meese and the Reagan administration and the Federalist Society. They were identifying young conservative jurists who they could groom for the Supreme Court, and Alito was one of those people. But when his big chance came, George W. Bush chose Harriet Myers. Some of us who remember those days can remember that fight. He chose, Bush chose a woman who he had been close to in Texas and had worked in his White House and was a pioneering woman attorney, much, much more of a moderate than Alito. And conservatives shocked America by standing up against against the president of their own party, decrying Harriet Myers, demanding somebody who was a proven conservative. And Alito fit that bill. You know, he had been 15 years on the lower court. He had an unwavering conservative record. But he was also a quiet person. You know, he it was hard to look at him. He's very shy and he's very kind of recessive in public. And it's hard to look at him and say, this man is an angry activist. And the model of activist had been Robert Bork, was the conservative who had been defeated 15 years earlier. And everybody wanted to avoid having another Bork. Alito seemed very, very calm, very cerebral. He was presented as a nerdy man of the law, somebody who would not shake things up. And he was able to sort of skate through a very difficult confirmation process. Because people sort of believed in his personal character, even though they knew that he was very, very conservative.
Given the conservative nature and the idea of when he started to realize, I think you write about this beautifully, and so to take it because it's in such incredible context in the book, so to pluck it out individually is deeply unfair. But could you just give us a sense of how he realizes his power within that conservative legal movement to the point of being able to exercise it?
I think that one thing, it changes a little bit over time. If you're talking about the time in which he was on the Supreme Court, it was still a very divided court when he first came on it. It was basically a 5-4 conservative court, but the swing vote, Anthony Kennedy, was not as conservative as Alito or Clarence Thomas or some of the other justices. So it was a bit of a struggle early on for him to assert himself as a conservative. Once the court started turning to the right, however, and a lot of that change happened even before the first Trump administration, when Kennedy started in his later years becoming a little bit more conservative in cases like Citizens United, I think that Alito's influence started coming to the surface because he was disciplined, he was knowledgeable about the law, he was an intellectual leader. He didn't always agree with his other fellow conservatives, but he sort of was the person where, you know, all roads could meet. In that way, I think he became a defining figure in certain areas. We saw he wrote the opinion in the voting rights case yesterday, and voting rights, limiting the scope of the Voting Rights Amendment has been, voting rights law has been a major focus of Alito's. Another major focus has been activating the free exercise of religion clause of the Constitution as a counterpoint to anti-discrimination laws. So you have places that have anti-discrimination laws, particularly against the LGBTQ plus community. Alito would say, well, there's a constitutional protection for free exercise of religion. So people who want to discriminate against gay people have a religious and they have a religious justification for it. They should be protected too. That's also been a big focus of Alito's. And these are major changes under the law, big transformative movements that aren't embodied in one case. They're embodied in many cases. When you put those together with the Dobbs decision, it's a very, very substantial impact that Alito has had on the court.
And talk about the impact on the court, but on his fellow justices of the working relationship and the of that of really an organizer, right? I mean, of someone who is seems to be leading a charge.
I think that he's a quiet organizer. You know, he studied when he was at Princeton under Professor Walter Murphy, whose entire focus was studying the internal dynamics of justices on the Supreme Court. Walter Murphy's theory was that the way to assert power on the Supreme Court is sort of a private internal kind of political act in which you have to get basically five justices on the same page. I don't think Alito projects as some master politician, again, because he's very shy, very recessive. I don't think he has close friendships on the court. But I think that intellectually, he's able to sort of embody a full range of conservative opinions in a way that's able to get some of his conservative colleagues on board, even if they're not completely aware that they're being drawn in by Sam Alito.
So talk about the Dobbs decision and him, Alito, writing the court's opinion. That plays a very special part in the book, a very poignant part in the book, as far as really a capstone, if you will, on his legal career. And I'm curious as to what went into that and what it was like to present that. All of these cases are important to go before the Supreme Court, but obviously this is something that has been on the radar for decades.
It has. And in many ways, the political power of the anti-abortion movement was crucial to the rise of the conservative legal movement. I don't think the conservative legal movement was exclusively about abortion when it was started. And in fact, the founders early on go out of their way to say that, you know, abortion was barely mentioned. Abortion wasn't, you know, this is not an anti-abortion movement. But after the Robert Bork defeat in 1987, which we talked about, which was when a conservative professor who embodied a lot of the sort of strict legal doctrines that were supported by the conservative legal movement, after he was struck down, his Supreme Court nomination was struck down because liberals led by Ted Kennedy simplified his views to, he supports back alley abortions. He supports keeping black people at segregated lunch counters. He, you know, it went through sort of a bill of horribles of what the effects of Robert Bork's jurisprudence would be. Conservatives felt that was deeply, deeply unfair. That, for example, they were only supporting the idea that abortion should be subject to the normal rules of politics, that it shouldn't be judges making the decision, that they were not at that time opposing abortion. They were just in favor of democracy, in a sense. Conservatives are very upset by that. After that, the movement changed, and it did embrace the political anti-abortion movement. And after that point, we're talking the late 1980s, people, I think, felt that overturning Roe v. Wade was the holy grail of the conservative legal movement. It was the great white whale, however you want to say it. It was their organizing goal. And many of them, up until the moment that the Dobbs decision came down in 2022, didn't think that it would happen, you know, because there were conservative justices who were believers in stare decisis, you know, support for precedent. One of them, it turned out, was Chief Justice Roberts, to some people's surprise. But Alito and his fellow conservatives persevered, and by a 5-4 margin, with Roberts concurring only in the result, so it looked like a 6-3 decision, but it was really a 5-4 decision, led by Alito, they were able to overturn abortion rights, which is, it sort of was the great white whale in two respects. One is, among legal conservatives who believed that Roe v. Wade was this unique overreach, that it was liberal justices putting their own values into the law. So there was a sort of legal revilement about the Roe v. Wade decision. But then there was also the moral objections and revilement of people who were pro-life voters and supporters who for years bemoaned Roe v. Wade. So it was absolutely the high watermark of the conservative legal movement.
The name of the book is Revenge for the 60s, Sam Alito and the Triumph of the Conservative Legal Movement. Peter Kanellis, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Be well. Thank you so much. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. We'll return after this break from the BBC.